This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're revisiting a conversation we had earlier this year with a Naples woman who spent a week on the set of public television show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. We'll hear some of her memories and listen to some classic moments from that show. But first, diversity is what unites us all. That's the underlying premise of the latest book by our guest today, Dr. Andrew Solomon. He's a writer and lecturer on politics, culture, and psychology. He's a winner of the National Book Award and an activist in LGBT rights, mental health, and the arts. He's been a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and has written for many other periodicals and has published a number of books. His latest book is called Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, which tells the stories of families raising exceptional children who not only learn to deal with their challenges, but also find profound meaning in the process. Dr. Solomon will be in Southwest Florida for two events at Florida Gulf Coast University early next week, but we get to talk to him today to preview some of the themes that he will cover. He joins us by phone. Andrew Solomon, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks so much for your time.
What a pleasure to be here.
And as always, we invite our audience to join the conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And on Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So your latest book explores parenting, telling the stories of parents raising exceptional children, like kids who are deaf or on the autism spectrum. And while I do want to get to what you write about and the process that you went through, like interviewing about 300 families, I want to start by asking if the idea for this book came about before or after you became a parent yourself.
Before I became a parent. It was while I was working on the book that I decided to become a parent and indeed that I had my children.
Really? What was that turning point? How did that happen?
Well, the book is really about families of children with a variety of differences, families of children with deafness and dwarfism, families of children with autism or Down syndrome or schizophrenia, families of children conceived in rape, families of children with a variety of other differences, families of transgender children and so on. And people said to me when I said I wanted to have children, how can you be deciding to have children in the middle of a book about everything that can go wrong? And I had to say over and over again, but it's not a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how much love and gratification there can be in the process of being a parent, even when everything is going wrong. And meeting the people I met while I worked on the book really gave me a kind of courage to face the idea of having children. It made me see that many different kinds of families function in many different ways, and that even if the child you have is not the child you would have imagined before you had him or her, this is still your child, and you'll find a way to love them.
It is a frightening prospect, becoming a parent. And in the beginning, you always think that you're just going to mess everything up. So I guess while talking with these families, you were watching as they explained how they functioned and moved on. One woman said either you can throw yourself a pity party or you just get over it.
Right. But the point was not only that they ended up figuring out a way to go on, but that they ended up finding a lot of meaning in the process of having these children who are different. It expanded the humanity not only of the children but also of the parents.
So, you know, I know about your becoming a parent because coincidentally your story was on Moth Radio Hour, which aired on WGCU over this past weekend. Tell me a little bit more about telling your story on The Moth.
So the story I told on The Moth is the story that is in the final chapter of Far From the Tree and very much drew from the work I'd done from Far From the Tree. I'll tell you just in the most condensed way the structure of my family, which is that my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. My best friend from college had got divorced but wanted to have a child, and so she and I have a daughter who now lives with mother and stepfather in Fort Worth, but I see them a great deal. And then John and I wanted to experience having a child full-time in our own household, so we have George, of whom I'm the biological father. John is the adoptive father. We had an egg donor, and our surrogate was Laura, the lesbian mother of John's two biological children. So it's six parents of four children in three states.
Wow, and talk about a modern family.
Exactly. it's a very modern family. And but it all came about very organically. It wasn't that we set out to do something that was kind of wild and crazy. The various situations presented themselves, and we pursued them as they did.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very joyful family. We all get along incredibly well, and we have a lot of time together, and we do a lot of things together. And in some ways, I felt like it was the culmination of the book. The book is about how people, as I've said, find meaning in difficult kinds of family, and it gave me the freedom to think there are many kinds of family, there are many ways to have children, there are there are many possibilities.
If you don't mind, I wanted to play a little bit from the end of that story. This is after you talk about being told by one of your husband's family members that your lifestyle was against their Christian values and that they wished to not have contact with you and your family anymore. Is there any more that you would like to add to set that up, or do you want me to just play it?
Why don't you play it, and then I'll respond to it.
Okay.
In the period that followed that, I kept thinking about the angry cousin and what he'd said. And I thought, it's not really a question of our kind of love being as good as, or better than, or less good than anyone else's love. It's simply another kind of love that we found as five parents of four children in three states. And I thought that just as species diversity is essential to keep the planet in place, so there's a need for a diversity of love to sustain the ecosphere of kindness, and that anyone who rejected any bit of the love in the world was acting in a foolish way and from a position of folly. About 6 months ago, we had gone to a park, and I had climbed up on a stand with George from which you could view some animals below. And I held his hand, and I said, we're going to go back down the steps now. Go very carefully. And I took one step, and I slipped, and I fell all the way down the flight of stairs, pulling him along behind me. And I remember when it happened, thinking that I really didn't care whether I had broken my arm or my leg, as long as I hadn't injured my child. It turned out that I hadn't. And when I felt it, I suddenly thought, the love you have for your children is like no other feeling, and until you have children, you'll never know. And I thought how, even in the periods when my mother saying that made me anxious or made me angry, that it was her saying it so persistently that had caused me to pursue a family, even under such complicated and difficult and elaborate circumstances, and that had led me finally to the greatest joys of my life. Thank you.
What you say there could not be more true. There is no love like the love that a parent experiences with a child, and it kind of takes you by surprise, actually, when you become conscious of it.
It's a great ambush. It's very poignant listening to that. I remember sliding down that flight of stairs with George pulled behind me. It was a long time ago now that it happened. Yes, I feel like there had been this persistent thing of my mother saying, the love for your children is like no other feeling in the world. And I wasn't sure whether it was true, although my relationship with my parents had been a very engaged and intense one, and I felt like it was kind of true from the children's side. But yes, once I had children, I discovered it really was true, and it was a revelation to me. And it was a revelation to me, really, because I had felt when I was growing up that I had to make this terrible, painful choice. I could either be true to myself and be gay, or I could live a kind of hidden life and have a family. And the two things I wanted most were to live authentically and to have a family, and it seemed like it was impossible to do both. And while I was trying endlessly to resolve that conundrum, the world changed around me, and it became possible, in fact, to be gay and to have a family. And I feel so grateful that I live in this time when I was able to do that. If I had been born 25 years earlier, it would have been out of the question. If I'd been born 25 years later, it might have been possible to do it more easily. But in any event, I'm very grateful to have been born when I was and to have the family I have.
Yeah, it's really staggering how much things have changed and how many more possibilities. That is such a difficult conundrum that you had to live with in the beginning of your life.
Yes, and I'm working on a new book now, which is partly about expanding ideas of family and about the many ways in which we've been drawn into other systems and other methods for having children, single parents by choice, open adoptions, all of these things that didn't exist when I was growing up.
Exactly. Well, we started the show talking, the first line was, diversity is what unites us all, and that was the underlying theme from your latest book. How does that diversity unite us? Is it that parental love for a child that we no matter what our familial situation is, it seems that we kind of experience a similar feeling or that similar tie. Is that the unifying thing? Is it that love? Or how can you tear that apart for me?
Well, a lot of people who have got one form of difference or another think of themselves as having something in common with other people who share their particular difference. So if you're a dwarf, you have something in common with other dwarfs. And if you're the parent of a dwarf, you have something in common with the parents of other dwarfs, but possibly not with very many other people. And the dwarf population of the United States is not enormous, and that's a very limited group to be involved with. But if you think that parents who are negotiating their way through difference and through having children who aren't what they expected all have something in common. If you say dwarfism is in some ways, as an experience within a family, very much like deafness and very much like Down syndrome and very much like these other things, then you discover that you're suddenly in a vast company. I've yet to meet any parent who hasn't from time to time looked at his or her child and said, what planet did you descend from? And the sense, that sense of difference, that sense of a gap between the parent and the child, and of how you negotiate that gap, and how you come to love the child you have rather than the child you imagined, that's a nearly universal experience. So my argument is that if instead of trying to look at what you all have in common, you look at what you have that's not in common, you will discover that the experience of not having those things in common gives you a common experience.
Yeah, because if in dealing with a child who has something different about them, you're going to go through pretty much the same stage of where did this come from? And then acceptance of, okay, this is what it is, and I'm still going to do whatever I can in my power to make it okay.
And ultimately, often, not only to acceptance of the child, but celebration. You know, as we just said, you fall in love with your child. You may think that your child has a rough life because of the condition they have, but most people don't wish away the children they have and wish that they had other better children instead. Most people love their own children, and that's nearly universal, and within the context of that, differences do unite us.
That is such a great way of looking at it. It's really eye-opening, listening to what you have to say and what you've written. It's just... I love it. So you have two events that are coming up next week here at Florida Gulf Coast University, and it's going to explore inclusion and belonging. And what I'm wondering, what kind of things have you learned about these subjects from being a parent yourself, and what kind of things will you be sharing with an audience?
Well, I'll talk a lot about being a parent myself. I'll talk a little bit about my experience with depression, which was, of course, the center of my previous book, as you mentioned in your generous intro. I really want to look at how in this moment when there are many national policies that seem to close down diversity and difference, and how valuable diversity and difference are, and to try to talk about how we make an inclusive society, which often begins with making inclusive campuses. How do we create a society where there is compassion for people who are different rather than disdain for them? And how can we recognize that we have enough to share with people who are different and that we don't have to kind of exclude them in order to be triumphant ourselves?
And I wonder, we talked a little bit earlier about how things have changed so much in recent decades, you know, in the last 10, 15 years. For acceptance and inclusion, there's more of that we're seeing, where things that previously may have been seen as impossible or not an option now are. But then we also still have these, like you mentioned, policies that have been put in place that kind of seem to be going in the opposite direction. Do you feel like this might be shaking off the last vestiges of historical categorizations, or do you feel like something, an old way of thinking, may be going down kicking and screaming?
There's always a sort of backwash. I mean, you make a certain amount of progress, and then people suddenly notice the progress, and they get very unhappy about the changes, and they try to keep things the way that they are or the way that they were. I would say it's a real, an urgent national question right now. Are we going to be a nation that does, as the United States historically has done, welcome strangers and say we'll find something in common? Or are we going to be a nation that tries to exclude people from the central discourse? And I think you can look at that through the lens of disability or race. You can look at sexism. You can look at all of the different forms of prejudice that have existed, homophobia. And you can say, are we going to increase those and continue to create these gaps between people? Or are we going to strive to break them down and to give people who have one situation compassion for those in another?
So I want to go back to I know I'm kind of jumping around because there's just so much to talk about, but I want to go back to the book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. You did a lot of research with that. How long did it take to put that together? Because you spent a lot of time with a lot of parents raising these exceptional children.
It took me 11 years to write Far From the Tree. It was a gigantic project. I mean, I was doing some other writing at the same time, so it wasn't all I was doing, but... It was very intense. It was, as you mentioned briefly, it was 300 families. I traveled all over the country to interview them. I even had some travel abroad to interview people in particular circumstances and situations. I felt like the proposal I was making was in some ways a radical proposal, that we all share these differences. And I felt I had to become an expert on the 12 different topics that are represented in the 12 chapters of the book. And it takes a lot of doing to become expert in 12 different areas. It was really like writing 12 books.
Yeah, there are 12 condensed books put together. It's really a staggering piece. And then on your website, there is video that accompanies. So it allows the reader to kind of get a visual of the people and how they interact with their kids.
Video on the website, and there's also, I should say, a documentary film based on the book that came out in July, and that's available now at Video On Demand. It's called Far From the Tree, and I co-produced it.
Yeah, I saw that on the website, too. How did that come about?
After the book came out, I was approached by more than 30 filmmakers who said that they were interested in making a documentary, and I went through a long process before I chose Rachel Dretson and Arc Media, and those are the people with whom I've been doing the project of making a film.
So that's available on Video On Demand, you said?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I have a little clip that I wanted to play. It kind of stood out for me. It's Bill and Chris Davis. It's a father and son. I want to listen to an excerpt of that real quick right now.
Chris is in 11th grade. And pretty much on his own in high school. He has a mentor that helps him.
No biting, Chris.
All right, Chrissy, go to Mom. Let him walk off if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Go to Mom and I'll be off in a minute. Go to Mom. Chris probably had one of the worst diagnoses ever. Self-injurious, swollen intestines, poisons in his systems, neurological damage, mental retardation, severe autism. Chris did not communicate, he didn't sit down, he didn't put on clothes, he wouldn't go outside. He ate the walls, he ate the table, he ate the rug. We couldn't eat in the home, we couldn't have lights on, we couldn't have the TV on. If I coughed, he would run downstairs and punch me. It was a 24-hour day job. Chris never slept, he never ate, he wore diapers, never spoke. And I was pretty much told to put him in an institution. It was obviously depressing. But so we went on this battle, you know, to educate and to provide therapies. And we continued against all odds, and he got better. The thing I've learned most over the years is to be a parent first. It changed my life completely, put me in another direction. I was able to love unconditionally. And I never thought of him as this poor, broken human being that we need to cure. You know, he's not sick.
That video was one of, well, several that brought me to tears earlier when I was doing the research for this. I mean, it was just so moving, the connection that you can see between Bill and Chris. Do you stay in touch with any of these people, or do any of them really stick with you?
Oh, I stay in touch with quite a lot of them. I think you can't write a book in which you ask people to tell you their innermost stories and then just disappear after the book is published. Bill and Chris are doing very well. Chris has started making a lot of art. He is much less given to the self-injurious behavior. He's in much better shape than he was at the time that we made that video. And Bill is a great guy. He's worked unbelievably hard with Chris to give him the level of functioning that he has.
Yeah, it sounds like Bill and Chris's mom both worked really hard and just kind of took it on as their job. But that's what parents are. Like you said, you got to be a parent first.
Well, Chris's mom was an amazing woman. She's now sadly deceased, but she didn't have a lot of educational or economic advantages. But when she had this child, she began doing research, and she went to all of the best places for the treatment of autism. And she then redeveloped some of the ideas that they had. And some of those people, you know, great scholars in the field with many advanced degrees, ended up coming to observe her work with Chris and to learn from it.
In the book, you explore what you call horizontal and vertical identities. Can you explain what that means?
So I think vertical identities are identities that are passed down generation to generation. So your ethnicity, your nationality, frequently your language, often your religion, those are things that parents are likely to have in common with their children. And some of those identities can be very difficult for children to process and can be difficult within our larger society. But but they nonetheless, nobody tries to cure them. You know, you can say it's tough to be black in America, but nobody is suggesting that the next generation of children born to Afro-American parents should be genetically engineered to be blonde-haired and blue-eyed. But then there are what I've called horizontal identities, so a variety of differences and disabilities, a variety of autism, Down syndrome, being gay, being transgender, and so on and so forth. Those are identities that you don't have in common with your parents. You have to learn the language of identity by interacting with a peer group. And often that peer group is discovered only in adolescence or thereafter when it comes as a great liberation. And so I'm very interested in how people with those horizontal identities go forward. And the tendency always has been, and still to some large extent is, to try to cure those horizontal identities because they're seen as differences and disabilities that are unfortunate. Claiming them as identities is a kind of radical political process.
I think it would be interesting also to take a look at how the different horizontal identities might deal with the vertical identities in different ways. I'm wondering, like, class, race, how they handle vertical identity differences differently.
Well, they handle the vertical identities differently, but the vertical identities tend to be reinforced. You know, if you're born to Latino parents or you're born to Muslim parents, you have your parents the whole time you're growing up saying, this is who you are and you should feel proud of it and helping to build you up. And if you are born deaf to hearing parents or you were born with Down syndrome to parents who don't have Down syndrome, often what the parents do is to feel like this grave misfortune is descended on the family. And instead of bucking up their kids, they undermine their sense of self. And so it takes a long time to rise above that.
So I read the book came out of your desire to forgive your parents who, while, quote, effortlessly accepting your dyslexia, flunked the same test when it came to your sexuality. Can you reflect on that time in your life?
Yes. I had dyslexia, and my mother, who had been a teacher, was very involved in helping me to learn to read. When I was a kid and was applying to first grade, I was turned down by 11 schools in New York on grounds that I was never going to learn to read or write. And I've had many problems in life, but that is not one of them. But I think the fact that my parents were able to bring about this change and were able to help me to become effectively, I mean, I'm not non-dyslexic, but I have a lot of compensatory strategies. It gave them the sense that, you know, anything that was troubling in me could be changed. And when I began to realize I was gay, I felt like they weren't going to be enthusiastic about it, and indeed they weren't enthusiastic about it, and it became a source of great tension and great difficulty between us.
Has it continued to be a source of tension?
No. My mother unfortunately died just a couple of years after I came out. I guess I came out when I was 23, and she died when I was 27, so 4 years later.
I'm sorry.
But she got sick within 2 years. My father is now, you know, deeply devoted to me, to my husband, to our children who are his grandchildren. He's been on board, and he threw us a really beautiful wedding. So I would say he's completely recovered from that discomfort.
He's recovered. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking to Dr. Andrew Solomon. He's the author of the best-selling book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. He'll be at FGCU next week for two presentations on inclusion and belonging. And if you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment about our conversation, feel free to give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So as I mentioned, next Monday, the 24th, you're going to be here at FGCU for two events. There's an afternoon one that's for students, and it's called A Conversation on Inclusion and Belonging. And in the evening, the event's open to everyone. It's called Radical Compassion, How Inclusion Benefits Us All. How do these two events differ? I mean, do you talk with students differently than you would with adults, or just different subject matter?
Well, the one with students is I'll be being interviewed on stage, so it'll be a conversation, and the one in the evening is a lecture, so they're sort of structurally different. I think some of the concerns of students are different from those of adults, and I think students are more prepared to accept radical points of view often than adults are. But effectively, I'm going to be talking about related areas, and there'll be a lot of overlap.
You've worked with college students for a lot of years. How do you think that their understanding of concepts like inclusion and belonging or even compassion have changed over that time, or have they changed at all?
Well, they have changed, I think. You know, we've gotten into this era in which there is on campuses, as everywhere else, a really sharp division between people who associate themselves with the right and people who associate themselves with the left. I think of myself as a sort of just to the left of center, but sort of relatively centrist, and I'm concerned by attempts on the left to shut down free speech by preventing people from coming to college campuses. And I'm concerned by the voices on the right that I think often lack compassion and understanding for their fellow human beings. So I think what I've seen is a polarization on campuses, and it's my hope that that's a phase and it will move back toward a more united front among students as among adults, but it may start very well among students in which people can see the merits of both sides.
We've talked a lot about the polarization, not only on college campuses, but in the world at large. But what's really interesting to me is on college campuses, you have kids who've been raised by their parents in their high school or in their town, wherever they came from, and they suddenly are in sometimes a different town or in a big college setting. And it's their first time that they are seeing diversity for many of these college kids. So I think I feel like it's kind of a critical time maybe to introduce some of the concepts of inclusion and acceptance and things like that and compassion.
Well, you know, and also to introduce the idea that diversity is actually quite rewarding as you engage with it, and that having comfort with a broader range of human beings makes you feel that the world is a friendlier place. I mean, we talk a lot about people excluding other people because they are afraid, and that happens often enough. But in the process of interacting with people who are different from you, you become less afraid and you recognize their humanity. It's much harder to hate anyone whose story you know. And as people engage with diversity, they know more and more stories and more narrative lines, and they find the world less and less threatening.
And you can't really do that if you're backing into your own corner and balling up your own argument to retort without listening.
Exactly.
Your book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, won the 2001 National Book Award for Nonfiction. It was a finalist for the 2002 Pulitzer Prize and was included in the Times of London's list of 100 best books of the decade. It's been published in more than 20 languages. What did that success mean for your career?
Well, it's enormously gratifying as a writer to have a larger audience, and the success of that book and of Far From the Tree has vastly expanded my audience beyond what it was before those two books came along. But I really felt when I was working on the depression book that there were memoirs about depression, there were scientific books, there were anthropological books, but there was nothing that pulled all of it together, and I wanted to write something that united the different kinds of ways there were to talk about depression. And I get letters often from people who are responding either to the book or to a TED Talk I did based on the book about depression, and they say that the book has helped them. I had one letter that was particularly poignant and that summed it all up. Someone wrote to me and said, I was going to kill myself, but I read your book and changed my mind. And, you know, there's nothing more gratifying as an author than feeling that you've actually been able to help and touch people with your words.
That is really incredible. I just can imagine when you get that letter and you read that and you're like, well, okay, well, I'm done. Thank you.
Yeah, it was all worth it, and now I can retire.
I know. Let's go out on a good note. The Noonday Demon, it's really an interesting. It examines the personal, cultural, scientific aspects of depression through interviews with the depression sufferers themselves, doctors, research scientists, politicians, pharmaceutical researchers. I mean, it looks at it from every angle, but I really am interested in the cultural striations of depression. I'm wondering, how much has our understanding of depression changed, do you think, since the publication of that book?
You know, it's changed and it's also stayed the same. I mean, Hippocrates described in ancient Greece 2,500 years ago depression in very much the same terms that we do now. What shifted primarily is our ability to treat depression and our sense of how it works. As we've had more treatments, people have come to be more open about their experiences with depression because there's now something to be accomplished by being open about your experiences. And that openness, I think, has been very, very important, even transformative for people who are living with depression. You know, a lot of people are still trying to keep it a big secret from everyone.
Yeah.
But as one person I interviewed said, it's the family secret that everyone has. It's incredibly pervasive. It affects 25% of the population at least. And it's a thing that, you know, it takes a lot of time and energy to fight depression, and it takes a lot of time and energy to keep a secret. And often the time and energy people are putting into keeping it secret would be better spent in trying to address it and correct it and fix it. That doesn't mean everyone has to write a book about it and be as open about it as I've been. But
yeah.
The opportunity to have people around you whom you trust and with whom you can discuss how you feel, I mean, that's unbelievably important. And it's definitely more possible to do that now than it was even when I wrote the book.
Exactly. Well, that's all the time that I have for this part of my show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Andrew Solomon, best-selling author of several books. We look forward to your visit.
Thank you so much.
When we return, we're listening back to a conversation we had with a local woman who got to spend a week on the set of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood back in the 80s while working on a story for Parents Magazine. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.